coronavirus pandemic surging and initial vaccine supplies limited, the United States faces a hard choice. Should the country's immunization program focus in the early months on the elderly and people with serious medical conditions who are dying of the virus at the highest rates, or on essential workers, an expansive category encompassing Americans who have borne the greatest risk of coronavirus infection? Healthcare workers and the frailest of the elderly, residents of long-term care facilities, will almost certainly get the first shots of the vaccine under guidelines from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, the guidelines issued on Thursday. But with vaccination expected to start this month, the debate among federal and state health officials about who goes next and lobbying from outside groups to be included is growing more urgent. It's a question increasingly guided by concerns over the inequities laid bare by the pandemic, from disproportionately high rates of infection and death among poor people and people of color, to disparate access to testing, childcare, and technology for online schooling. It's a damnable that we are even being placed in this position, that we have to make these choices, said Reverend William J. Barber II, a co-chairman of the Poor People's Campaign, a national coalition that calls attention to the challenges of the working poor. But if we have to make the choice, we cannot once again leave poor people and low-wealth essential workers to be last. Ultimately, the choice comes down to whether preventing death or curbing the spread of the coronavirus and returning to some semblance of normalcy is the highest priority. If your goal is to maximize the preservation of human life, then you would bias the vaccine towards older Americans, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former Food and Drug Administration FDA commissioner, said recently. Dr. Scott Gottlieb added, "If your goal is to reduce the rate of coronavirus infection, then you would prioritize essential workers. So it depends what impact you're trying to achieve." The trade-off between the two is muddied by the fact that the definition of essential workers used by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, comprises nearly 70% of the American workforce, sweeping in not just grocery store clerks and emergency responders, but also tugboat operators and nuclear energy workers. Some labor economists and public health officials consider the category overboard and say it should be narrowed to only those who interact in person with the public. About 70% of workers in the U.S. have jobs that are considered essential. A subset are considered frontline workers, meaning their jobs cannot be performed from home. An independent committee of medical experts that advises the CDC on immunization practices will soon vote on whom to recommend for the second phase of vaccination, Phase 1B. In a meeting last month, all voting members of the committee indicated support for putting essential workers ahead of people over the age of 65 and older, and those with higher risk health conditions. An independent committee of medical experts that advises the Center for Disease Control and Prevention on immunization practices will soon vote on whom to recommend for the second phase of vaccination. Historically, the committee relied on scientific evidence to inform its decisions, but now the members are weighing social justice concerns as well. According to Lisa Posser, a professor of health policy and decision sciences at the University of Michigan. Dr. Lisa Posser says, "To me, the issue of ethics is very significant, very important for this country." Dr. Peter Zilagli, a committee member and a pediatrics professor at the University of California in Los Angeles, says at the time, "Clearly, this favors the essential workers group because of the high proportion of minority, low-income and low-education workers among essential workers. That position runs counter to the framework proposed by the World Health Organization, WHO, that the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine, and many countries which say that reducing deaths should be the unequivocal priority, and that older and sicker people should thus go before the workers, a view shared by many in the public health and medicine industry. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the nation's top public health official, reminded the advisory committee of the importance of older people, saying in a statement on Thursday that he looked forward to future recommendations that, based on vaccine availability, demonstrate that we as a nation also prioritize the elderly. Once the committee votes, Dr. Robert Redfield will decide whether to accept its recommendations as the official guidance of the agency. Only rarely does the CDC director reject a recommendation from the committee, whose 14 members are selected by the Health and Human Services Secretary, serve 4.5-year terms, and have never confronted a task as high in profile as this one. But ultimately, the decision will be up to governors and state and local officials, health officials. They are not required to follow the CDC guidelines, though historically they have done so in the past.
Africa Today.
A nearly three-decade-old ceasefire has ended in occupied Western Sahara, marking the onset of upcoming tensions in the region.
The opposing sides are the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement that seeks independence from the monarchy.
The Polisario is mobilizing thousands of volunteers to join for the fight after the Moroccan military broke into Guergerat, a restricted area technically under Polisario sovereignty.
Morocco has publicly and officially acknowledged the fact of launching an armed attack on a group of civilians demonstrating peacefully in Western Sahara.
I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Ikram Abdikarim. Welcome to Africa Today. In this episode, we take you to the Western Sahara, where open warfare appears to be on the horizon.
Now, fighting has reportedly broken out in several areas between the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, and it could have impacts far beyond Morocco.
I have also prepared news from all over Africa for you. Stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
Tensions in Africa's last colony.
I say that our damnation comes from the natural resources we have here. If it wasn't for these natural resources, Morocco would never have invaded Western Sahara.
If we don't speak out, especially us as victims who have suffered all of this, if we don't speak out and defend our cause, this problem will remain.
Hostilities began after a Morocco-built road was reportedly blocked by the Polisario, and the kingdom's trade route with Mauritania was cut. Violation of the ceasefire after 29 years since it was clinched could undermine peace and security in the rest of the region. The ceasefire agreement was reached between the Polisario Front and Morocco after several engagements between 1989 and 1991.
We are sure, as we are sure that God exists, that the Saharan people's objective is independence, and that is a right we must address today, tomorrow, next year, in our time, in our children's time. It doesn't matter when. The important thing is to achieve national independence. The conditions we are living in, the weakness in policy and failures of the Moroccan kingdom, the importance of the Saharan case in the world today and the focus of Saharan people on independence are indicators that victory is imminent. Independence is imminent.
The kingdom has managed to occupy and administer 80% of the territory.
Since then, thousands have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation.
The media blockade Moroccans have imposed on Western Sahara is also quite infamous.
We are now joined by Mr. Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest from London. Mr. Hamdi, thanks for joining us. Now, can you walk us through the latest round of violence in Western Sahara?
There is a road that goes from Morocco to Mauritania that is used for the transport of goods. There was a protest that took place from the inhabitants of the Western Sahara. The Moroccan government accused these groups of being part of the Polisario. It's not clear if they were. So they sent in the army, which fired warning shots. The Polisario say that the Moroccans actually fired on the protesters. And the Moroccan army moved into that area, which is a buffer zone, and built a sand wall in order to try to prevent that road from being blocked again. The Moroccans believe that the Polisario are trying to force a new war, and the Polisario believe that the Moroccans are further cementing their de facto control of much of the territory.
Thanks for that, Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief, the International Interest magazine.
Western Sahara has been occupied by Morocco since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Although the four-decade-old conflict has its roots in nearly a century of brutal colonization by Spain. Madrid agreed to hand over Western Sahara to Mauritania and Morocco in 1975, triggering tensions that continue to this day.
On the 21st of October, Polisario bring women and children and block the crossing point of Gargarat. Immediately, the Secretary General have been alerted by Morocco, and we alerted also the Security Council. And since 21st of July, of October, Secretary General made two calls to Polisario to withdraw from Gargarat, not to block civil and commercial traffic, and also not to change the statutes of this area.
Pro-independence Sahrawis living in the occupied territory stage more and more protest against the Moroccan rule established with the help of the United States.
Morocco reportedly took military action hours after U.S. Major General Andrew Rohling met with the commander of the Royal Moroccan Armed Forces Southern Zone.
We are now joined by Mr. Edward Corrigan, an international lawyer from Ontario, to hear his take on the significance of this meeting.
Well, obviously, the United States is a supporter of the Kingdom of Morocco. Morocco is considered a conservative Arab government. It's under, you know, very, you know, quietly supported by the Americans. And obviously, the American generals gave green light to Morocco to for any invasions or going into the buffer zone. So the Americans are definitely involved. Morocco has, you know, a history of a poor human rights record, not only in the old Spanish Sahara, but also in its own country. And there's some allegations that the Polisario Front also has some human rights problems.
Now, relations between the Moroccan and the U.S. militaries have grown in recent years, mostly thanks to cooperation over the American military command in Africa, AFRICOM.
Just recently, the United States and Morocco signed an accord that aims to strengthen military operations over the next decade.
Morocco hosts one of the largest training exercises organized by AFRICOM. It's called the African Lions Annual Exercise, where countries from all over Africa participate. It's usually held provocatively, I think, in southern Morocco, not too far from Western Sahara. So it certainly it's not good optics that Morocco chose to launch this military incursion in violation of the UN ceasefire on the same day that military commanders were in Morocco preparing for the annual African Lion Exercise.
Now, Washington is the monarchy's largest supplier of arms, and it hosts an annual U.S. military exercise called African Lion. Morocco signed a peace treaty with the U.S. in 1786, which is still in force today.
The Moroccan government also enjoys support from some U.S. region allies such as Turkey and the UAE?
I think the U.S. has been trying to deploy as much as it can in terms of leverage in order to push other countries to normalize ties with Israel, whether that's by making promises of recognizing Moroccan control of the Western Sahara, or whether that's by making promises of incentives to push Morocco to assert what it believes is its right to the Western Sahara. This is all possible. However, it's not a guarantee that Morocco necessarily responded to these U.S. demands. The reality is that there were the road was blocked. There were protests. The Polisario have acknowledged that as well. It does affect transport of goods between Morocco and Mauritania.
The latest round of tensions in the rest of region could spiral out of control. Neighboring Algeria, which is home to Sahrawi refugees, could be dragged into the conflict, potentially causing an all-out war. Major weapon sales to Morocco by the Trump administration have even raised concerns, yielding a scenario which Morocco might be looking for a U.S. recognition of Western Sahara in exchange for Rabat's recognition of Israel.
إسرائيل ليست عدوا للمغرب على أي حال ليست عدوا للمغرب بل في الماضي قدمت بعض الخدمات استعلاماتية واستخباراتية
على كل حال هذا ما يقوله محور معين في الإقليم
هذه هي الحقيقة يا أستاذة
بالنسبة لك هناك محور آخر لا يعتبر هذا
يعني ليس
حقيقة
ليس هناك احتقان إسرائيلي أو حقد إسرائيلي على المغرب
The U.S. even got close to recognizing Western Sahara as Moroccan territory under the George W. Bush administration. Meanwhile, the Sahrawi civilians remain the true victims, wary of empty promises by the U.N. Security Council and the U.N. Secretariat, and no resolution in sight.
This is all part of the mess that the Europeans created after in Africa, where they divided up the country in the 1984 Berlin Conference. But, you know, all of the countries and the lines and the map, you know, really don't correspond to the ethnic groups in the area and linguistic groups. So, you know, that's why there's so much instability in Africa, where these countries are, you know, trying to live under these artificial lines. And as I've read elsewhere, Africans just sort of ignore the lines. They just do whatever they want. So that's the issue. So until the Americans get serious and the European Union gets serious.
And now my colleague is ready to present you with news and events from across Africa. What do you have in store for us today, Kram?
Thank you, Henya. Welcome back to more news from all over Africa. And now, on to the first one. World's white giraffe has been fitted with a track device in Kenya to protect it from poachers, as one white female and her calf were killed by poachers in March. Its white appearance is due to leucism, which causes skin cells to have no pigmentation. Parliament approves deal for Rwanda Air to fly to 5 new routes. Rwanda ratified agreements with Brazil, Democratic Republic of Congo, Namibia, Somalia, and Tunisia, bringing the total number of BASA ratified by Parliament to 52. The country is also expected to sign agreements with South Korea and Malta. Thirdly, Burkina Faso election takes place amid terrorist threats. People have voted in Burkina Faso's presidential election, although polls are closed in parts of the north and east because of fears of terrorist violence. Now, clashes with police sparked by the arrest of Ugandan presidential candidate and former pop star Robert Chagulani, commonly known as Bobby Wine, has left at least 28 people dead since Wednesday. He was later charged with spreading coronavirus at a campaign rally. Police in Uganda have a right to shoot protesters dead if they reach a certain level of violence, Security Minister Eli Temwini has said. Also in West Africa, Nigerian photographer Obinna Obioma is using creative ways to display an iconic West African plastic bag to reflect on migration. Recognized around the world in either its blue, white, and red, white varieties, this once nameless bag in West Africa has long been especially popular in markets across the region. Last but not least, Nigeria's economy slips into recession. 6, Nigeria has slipped into recession, with the latest growth figures showing the economy's contracted 2.06% between April and June. The country has now seen two consecutive quarters of declining growth, the usual definition of recession. I hope you enjoyed the news. Don't forget to comment, and interactions are highly welcome. And stay tuned for more from me and the entire Africa team today. Thank you.
Tensions in Africa's last colony.
A full-blown military conflict in the disputed desert territory in northwest Africa could exacerbate the lives of locals already under pressure.
With a protracted war in Libya, long simmering insurgency in Mali, and an armed conflict in Ethiopia, hostilities in Western Sahara add to regional instability.
Now, the Polisario Front argues that the resumption of armed struggle is aimed at defending the legitimate rights of Sahrawis.
Frankly speaking, at the moment, it's very difficult to talk about any peaceful negotiations because Morocco has already launched a military attack on our land and our people, to which we have had to respond. So it all depends on how the developments on the ground. But if you just allow me very quickly to remind your viewers that the whole crisis started when Morocco launched an attack on a group of civilians who were protesting peacefully against Morocco's illegal occupation of Western Sahara, a violation that the United Nations...
The sparsely populated territory has worried international observers, who fear it could turn into a hub for terrorists. Natural resources are meanwhile being plundered from phosphates to fish.
Now, in order to isolate the southern parts of the Western Sahara, Morocco also built a 2,700-kilometer sand wall in the 1980s, which is equipped with a barrier mine belt, thought to be the longest continuous minefield in the world.
I think there's always a risk of that, but I do think that there is little appetite on both sides for an all-out war. And I think the key reason for that is that Morocco has been able to access the Western Saharan area and been able to invest and take advantage of the area economically. I think Algeria is not in the mood to get engaged in a conflict, given that the president is ill, given that the country is going through transition, given that the regime is under significant pressure from its own domestic situation, whether that's Corona, whether that's the popular protest. And Mauritania is engaged in a bitter political struggle, the third player in this, in a bitter political struggle between the former president and the current president.
Rabat seeks to secure passage of trucks to Mauritania via Gargarat border crossing. Morocco has also played down the clashes occurred, asserting that the three-decade truce still stands. But does it? Morocco, on the other hand, says that its activities in Western Sahara are merely aimed at free circulation of civilian and commercial traffic with neighboring Mauritania.
This route is important when it comes to the movement of civilians and goods, and because such actions were a violation of the UN-sponsored ceasefire agreement, Morocco, in order to fulfill its duties, ordered its military forces to intervene and build a sand barrier to protect the area from any future breaches.
Morocco considers the resource-rich territory of Gargarat as the integral part of the kingdom. Gargarat is located on the southern coast of the disputed Western Sahara, along the road leading to Mauritania.
Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area, irrespective of the ceasefire lines, and Algeria has been able to benefit because it's always been able to use the Western Sahara as a way to keep Morocco embroiled in separate issues instead of antagonizing Algeria from Algeria's perspective. So it may well be that what Polisario is doing is trying to flex its muscles, in given that Algeria itself is looking at other military priorities. Almost as the Polisario is saying, Algeria, we're still here, so make sure you continue to support us.
The Gargarat standoff exposes the vulnerability of Morocco's strategy of driving business growth as a major player in the sub-Saharan economy.
The latest round of violence also represents culmination of diplomatic failures to broker a sustainable peace deal to determine who controls Africa's last colony.
Now, after decades of disputes, Morocco's strategy appears to be refusing self-determination, and Polisario is rejecting Rabat's autonomy.
Power players in the region are also taking the chance to employ Western Sahara as a proxy for a wider struggle for influence in Northwest Africa. So, what repercussions can the conflict have for the region?
It depends if the regional countries are actually in favor of war. I think when it comes to analyzing the Polisario's propensity for war, or not propensity, if they have their desire for a renewed conflict, that all depends on the mood in Algeria, which is one of the prime backers of the Polisario, and the extent to which the Polisario believes that it will be able to secure international sympathy for its case, for its cause, for what's going on in the region. I do think that Morocco itself is not interested in a full-blown conflict. The reality is that both Morocco and Algeria, the two key international players in this conflict, are both happy with the status quo. Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area.
Different generations of Sahrawis have grown up in refugee camps in Algeria, with no resolution surrounding their fate as the indigenous inhabitants of the region. Yet for Rabat, Western Sahara is a matter of national security, and King Mohammed IV has threatened to respond to any threat severely.
The journalists, observers, and activists who come from abroad are expelled. So what do? We break through this blockade from within. We are the witnesses. I'm going to suffer. If I do this work, I suffer more, yes. I'm going to make more sacrifices. But if I don't, I will always live under occupation.
Rabat appears to be entrenching the occupation by betting on time in what it portrays as an ongoing political process. The process, which had already failed, now looks way more distant as new clashes break out and hostilities increase.
That would be serious. Of course, Morocco, I think, is looking for, you know, seizing the resources of the area, maybe, you know, oil, gas, other things. And while Morocco has control of the seaside and 80% of the territory, the Polisario Front controls 20% along the Algerian and Mauritanian border. But it is, yeah, most definitely could explode into something very serious. But, you know, we are talking about a, you know, there's only 60,000 people, 600,000 people that live in the area.
The United Nations has expressed grave concerns over the possible consequences of the conflict. The UN has also vowed to do its utmost to avoid the collapse of the 1991 ceasefire.
A UN mission known as MINURSO is also present on the scene, but will any of that be helpful?
The Secretary General remains committed to doing his utmost to avoid the collapse of the ceasefire that has been in place since 6 September 1991. And he is determined to do everything possible to remove all obstacles to the resumption of the political process.
Just recently, the UN Security Council decided to extend the mandate of the United Nations peace operation in Western Sahara for another year.
Delegates also called for a swift appointment of a new personal envoy of the UN Secretary General to push for the Western Sahara peace process. Now the new clashes are presenting a new challenge to the world body, stopping an all-out war.
It's, you know, a low-level conflict, but it could easily explode into something much more serious and possibly bring in, you know, Algeria into the conflict as well as Morocco, and depending on what the Americans would do. But they've been supporting Morocco and have been consulting them and providing them arms. So, yeah, it could explode, but this conflict has been going on actually for many, many years. But since Spain withdrew in 1975, and Mauritania withdrew under pressure from the Polisario Front later. But it's not a densely populated area. There's a little over, not even 600,000 people in the area.
Thanks for that, Mr. Corrigan.
Today, Sahrawis have no reason to believe in the words of the UN, which promised a referendum in 1991, but has done nothing to make it actually happen. The native population is therefore fighting for freedom as more troops head to Moroccan positions along the separation wall.
I do think that the Polisario, which relies on international backing in order to stand up to Morocco, may find that international backing lacking in this current environment in which the region finds itself in, or in particular the current environment in which each of the individual countries find themselves in as a result of their domestic struggles.
According to some reports, the Moroccan military has shown weak performance in some instances, allowing Polisario forces to take over some positions easily.
As tensions soar, the Moroccan media has mostly remained silent as if nothing is happening.
This is why the Sahrawis' right to self-determination are being denied, a denial coupled with reports of heavy crackdown on protests. People are suffering, but the news never gets out.
That wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today.
And we pray for the end of violence and suffering all over the world.
Please know that your thoughts and comments are always welcome.
Until we come back again, it's goodbye from me, Mubarak Kenya.
And goodbye from me, Ikram Abdikarim, and the entire team.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations top official on torture on Tuesday, December 8, called for British authorities to release or place under house arrest WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing the risk of COVID-19 infection in London's notorious Belmarsh prison and condemning a decade of arbitrary deprivation of liberty that has severely violated the jail journalist's human rights. The WikiLeaks founder's prolonged solitary confinement in a high-security prison is neither necessary nor proportionate, said United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture Nils Melzer. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Not a Criminal. Top UN anti-torture official urges Julian Assange release. Here's the details. The United Nations top official on torture on Tuesday, December 8, called for British authorities to release or place under house arrest WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, citing the risk of COVID-19 infection in London's notorious Belmarsh prison and condemning a decade of arbitrary deprivation of liberty that has severely violated the jailed journalist's human rights. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture Nils Melzer's comments came in a statement noting reports that some 65 of the 165 inmates at Belmarsh, including numerous prisoners in the wing where Assange is jailed, have tested positive for coronavirus. Assange's legal team has repeatedly called for his release, citing pre-existing health conditions, including heart problems and respiratory infections that place The 49-year-old journalist and publisher at elevated risk for potentially deadly COVID-19 complications. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention previously found that Assange had been arbitrarily deprived of his freedom since his arrest on December 7, 2010, including house arrest, imprisonment in London, and 7 years spent receiving political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in the British capital. Assange has been imprisoned in Belmarsh in conditions described by Meltzer as near total isolation since April 2019, as he awaits a UK court's decision on whether he will be extradited to the United States to face charges of violating the 1917 Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for publishing classified US military documents and files on WikiLeaks a decade ago. Among the materials published by WikiLeaks are the Afghanistan and Iraq war logs, which revealed U.S. and coalition war crimes, many of them leaked by Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Perhaps the most infamous of the leaks is the so-called collateral murder video, which shows U.S. Army attack helicopter crews laughing as they gunned down a group of Iraqi civilians that included journalists and children. While the soldiers and commanders implicated in the materials published by the WikiLeaks have largely enjoyed impunity, Manning served 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by outgoing President Barack Obama in 2017. Meanwhile, Assange faces up to 175 years behind bars if found guilty of all charges against him. The British authorities initially detained Ms. Assange on the basis of an arrest warrant issued by Sweden in connection with allegations of sexual misconduct that have since been formally dropped due to lack of evidence, Meltzer said in a statement. Today, he is detained for exclusively preventative purposes to ensure his presence during the ongoing U.S. extradition trial, a proceeding which may well last several years. Mr. Assange is not a criminal convict and poses no threat to anyone. So his prolonged solitary confinement in a high-security prison is neither necessary nor proportionate and clearly lacks any legal basis, Meltzer continued. There have been growing calls for President Donald Trump to pardon Assange during his last week in office, including by exiled former National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden, filmmaker Oliver Stone, and musician Roger Waters. Meltzer, who has repeatedly called Assange's treatment torture, added that the whistleblower's rights have been severely violated for more than a decade. Additionally, Meltzer advised British authorities to decline the U.S. extradition request, citing serious human rights concerns in a nation whose prisons are rife with torture, rape, and other abuses. He must now be allowed to live in a normal way, normal family, social, and professional life, to recover his health and to adequately prepare his defense against the U.S. extradition request pending against him, he said. Thank you.
European News Bulletin.
My name is Saeed Puruza. Our top story, we begin in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, where Nobel Prizes have been awarded for achievements in various fields over the course of the year. While the ceremony brought some much-needed cheer in a year riddled with so much difficulty, concerns surrounding next year's humanitarian challenges are never too far away. Mortaza Jaffer starts us off.
So many times before,
as the year comes to a close, so too does the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Only this time history was made with the committee in Sweden while the laureates appeared on screen socially distant across the globe. Awards were handed for numerous categories, but the feature standout remains the Peace Prize. In this pandemic year, with economies reeling and record numbers of refugees fleeing war, famine and disease, the UN World Food Programme were awarded the prize for their efforts tackling hunger across the globe.
Wow. Waking up this morning in this beautiful city here in Rome, it's hard to imagine that in about 400 AD, this city experienced a massive famine. It ended up killing almost 90% of its population. It's hard to imagine us going through a famine like that. But my tragic duty today is to tell you, famine is at humanity's doorstep for millions and millions of people on Earth. Because of so many wars, climate change, the widespread use of hunger as a political and military weapon, and a global health pandemic that makes all of that exponentially worse, 270 million people are marching towards starvation. Failure to address their needs will cause a hunger pandemic which will dwarf the impact of COVID.
270 million people is equivalent to the combined populations of the UK, Germany, France, and Italy, all at the brink of starvation. What's more, the coronavirus pandemic has sharply escalated the severity of the crisis. As senior UN officials convened at the General Assembly, the message was clear. 2021 is shaping up to be an even greater humanitarian catastrophe as global coronavirus cases continue to accelerate. With vaccines offering a way out, the fear remains that poorer nations will be left behind.
We simply cannot accept a world in which the poor and marginalized are trampled by the rich and powerful in the stampede for vaccines. This is a global crisis, and the solutions must be shared equitably as global public goods, not as private commodities that widen inequalities and become yet another reason some people are left behind.
According to the UN, global measures to tackle the virus have fueled a 40% increase in the number of people relying on humanitarian help and have appealed once again for wealthier nations to assist developing countries struggling to cope. Vaccines are currently being administered in the UK, Canada, and Russia, with various Western nations soon to begin the rollout. However, the nature of the pandemic is such, failing to tackle the problem globally will only mean the threat of another wave that will only delay a return back to normal.
A pandemic that will dwarf the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Mortaza Jaffer there. Speaking of the coronavirus pandemic, it has affected everyone's life one way or another, but it's dealt a heavier blow to some more than others. Food charities in the UK are referring to them as the newly hungry, a growing cohort of people previously in good jobs and enjoying decent incomes. The hardest hit among them, families with children.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Randry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
if there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a zero-hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her three-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warned these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pureza, London.
UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that there is now a strong possibility that Britain will crash out of the EU without a trade deal at the end of the year. He said British firms should carefully prepare for what's to come after December 31st. Wading into the squabble, EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen spoke of the key issues between the two sides earlier today.
Positions remain apart on fundamental issues. On the level playing field, we have repeatedly made clear to our UK partners that the principle of fair competition is a precondition to privileged access to the EU market. It is the largest single market in the world, and it is only fair that competitors to our own enterprises face the same conditions on our own market.
The two sides have said this Sunday as the deadline for an agreement and said they didn't believe talks would continue beyond that. The Netherlands-based UN Special Tribunal for Lebanon has sentenced a member of the Hezbollah resistance movement to life for alleged involvement in the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The sentencing comes months after a hearing convicted Salim Ayash in absentia of being involved in the suicide truck bombing on Beirut's seafront that killed Hariri and 21 others. The investigation has been criticized for its lack of evidence linking Ayash to the bombing. Hezbollah have repeatedly denied any involvement. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, has defended the government's controversial new anti-radicalization law, saying that accusations of Islamophobia against the bill are largely misrepresented. France has faced a fierce backlash from Muslim leaders across the world after it presented legislation it says will clamp down on, quote, radical Islam. New measures to be imposed will include tightening rules on religious-based education and registering mosques as places of worship. France has been accused of being Islamophobic after President Emmanuel Macron defended blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and described Islam as being in crisis. The European Union has extended sanctions against Russia by another 6 months. European Council President Charles Michel
announced that EU leaders had agreed to impose a wave of new sanctions targeting the Russian economy, including the oil sector. The new measures will continue until the end of July next year. The move comes days after the U.S. imposed further bans on several Russian individuals and entities. Moscow's ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Antonov, has warned the move will further deepen the crisis in relations between the two world powers.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
After the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan, Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to strike a deal to establish full diplomatic relations with, guess whom? Israel. Another gift to Benjamin Netanyahu from the outgoing Trump administration in the U.S., condemned by Palestinians, Iran, and all those loyal to the Palestinian struggle. Robert Enriquez has been keeping his ear to the ground and joins me now with more details on that story. Robert, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Saeed. And this move has been described as another stab in the back of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause by the Arab regimes, and of course makes it harder for the Arab Peace Initiative to work if it was a so-called two-state solution that they were aiming for the international community. And we see little condemnation from the international community of these moves as of recently. But before we go further into this story, let's play a clip of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli premier himself, announcing this. And he's very happy with himself. So check it out.
I've always believed that this historic day would come. I've always worked for it. I want to first thank President Trump for his extraordinary efforts to expand peace, to bring peace to Israel and the peoples of the Middle East.
He says he knew this day would come, Robert.
Well, this has been in the planning for some time now. And of course, Donald Trump is doing all he can whilst he is in office to put Netanyahu in a favorable position to his own population. But less on that and more on the fact that he said peace in the region, which is quite a funny thing because the Western Sahara now, the occupied Western Sahara, has just been declared by the U.S. Trump administration to belong to Morocco. And that would mean essentially that the hundreds of thousands of refugees, Sahrawi refugees, which are currently living in Algeria, would essentially be remain as refugees for the
foreseeable future. Robert, about that, what does a recognition by a U.S. administration of a country's sovereignty over a region, in this case Moroccan sovereignty over West Sahara, mean?
Well, of course, it doesn't have international recognition. The Western Sahara as a independent nation has backing by the international community to say that it should be an independent state and should be a UN member. However, we have seen that the Polisario Front, which is the National Liberation Movement for Western Sahara, has not been ever granted that ability to come to a vote. And at this moment right now, we've seen just, and it's not a coincidence that just in the past months, the ceasefire, the 30-year-long ceasefire which held, has broken down. And guess who's involved in that? The United Arab Emirates, who have just placed their consulate over in Western Sahara on behalf of the Moroccans. The Morocco as well, we have to understand, trying to get closer to the U.S. Trump administration and being pressured on the issue, in 2017 abandoned ties with Iran. And now we see this after the United Arab Emirates have made such a push and had been backing Morocco on the issue so hard. And even there's allegations that UAE fighter jets were used to bombard positions in the Western Sahara. So this is something that has been in the making for some time. And when Netanyahu talks about peace, what peace has come out of this?
That's a very good point, Robert, isn't it? Basically what they're saying is you want F-35s, you got to have Benjamin Netanyahu's number. You want 14,000 bombs, in the case of the UAE buying those bombs from the Americans, call Netanyahu. because they have clout, the Israeli lobby or whatever, they have clout in the American administration, and they can really deliver the goods.
Absolutely. And the UAE, when it comes to building bridges for other so-called peace deals to be put on the table, is the perfect asset to have in the Middle East. Its intelligence agency operates. It has a vast intelligence apparatus. And we even saw in the case of Sudan normalization, that was largely due to UAE influence in Sudan, which many people don't really hear about, and many people don't even understand. And when it comes to Morocco, yet again, we see UAE fingerprints there, because the UAE is working on behalf of Israel. And of course, this deal for the UAE has meant opening up of more trade relationships for the United Arab Emirates and weapons, like you said.
All right, take us online and some online reaction.
The first one we have here says, and this is from an Israeli user, they say, diplomatic ties with Israel gets the UAE stealth jets, Morocco, Western Sahara, Sudan sanctions relief, and then Bahrain Chabad House. Bit of a stab there. And then we've got a reply to this from a user called Mo, who says, Sudan hasn't gotten anything tangible. The US uses a stick and the image of a carrot approach with the government of Sudan. Basically a blackmail policy that mostly the Sudanese people pay for rather than the government, typically a US foreign policy. We have another one commenting on this issue here as well, a user called Khalil, who says, UN stance on Western Sahara remains unchanged. The UN spokesperson ruins Morocco's colonial regime, rejoicing over usual anarchic personal proclamations of real Donald Trump. That's his Twitter handle, legally gifting it what he does not possess, the occupied Western Sahara.
And this whole thing, Robert, what it does is really calls into question the relevance of the United Nations, because no one seems to be listening to the UN. You said something earlier about the UAE working on behalf of Israel. But what can also be said about this whole thing is the American administration, the Trump administration, over the past 4 years, using its influence around the world to benefit Israel, or from an Israeli standpoint, Benjamin Netanyahu and his band of Likud party members using American influence to their own benefit.
Absolutely. And we have a piece now on that and what Donald Trump has delivered for Israel during his time in office. And of course, this is ongoing, as we've seen with this story on Morocco. So more on that now.
As Donald Trump nears the end of his time as President of the United States, he continues to tighten U.S. support for Israel. But what exactly has Trump done in office that has made him the most pro-Israel president in U.S. history? Let's take a look at what Trump's pro-Israel record looks like. Whilst in office, Trump notably recognized Israel's undivided capital as being Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in December of 2017, later moving the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv in May of 2018. Donald J. Trump then also unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, at the behest of Netanyahu and the Israel lobby in the United States. As president, he also saw it fit to kick out the PLO from their office in Washington, D.C. This is prior to him structuring a so-called peace deal, which was supposed to, in the words of Trump, favor both the Israelis and Palestinians. In June of 2018, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley announced that the U.S. was withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council, citing biased criticism of Israel being one of the principal reasons for the U.S. doing so. Whilst the embassy move was ongoing, a massacre was committed of Palestinian peaceful protesters in Gaza, as Israeli snipers targeted and murdered over 60 unarmed demonstrators, including journalists and medics. Trump's administration sat by throughout the entire course of what was to be named the Great Return March in Gaza, constituting one of the largest, by percentage of the besieged Gazan population, nonviolent protest movements in history. The Trump administration defended Israel repeatedly, claiming that Israel was under attack and defended itself. This is despite a UNHRC report, as well as countless human rights group reports, categorically debunking this as a lie. The silence on the part of the U.S. Trump administration amounted to Israel murdering at least 330 unarmed demonstrators, injuring 35,000. No Israelis were significantly injured or killed. The United States not only cheered on Israel as it massacred the people of the Gaza Strip, but went a step further, In August of 2018, Trump withdrew all funding from UNRWA, or the UN agency set up to help Palestinian refugees. Gaza's population is a 70%+ population of refugees. In 2019, Trump signed an order recognizing the illegally occupied Golan Heights as being Israeli territory, contrary to